Still on the general subject of alternatives to atomism, general ontological conceptions, which we regard as forming alternatives to atomism, to the view of the world as, in some sense, comprising the totality of objects, which are, intuitively speaking, structureless relative to the conceptual resources of the language description, which are intuitively speaking structureless relative to the conceptual resources devoid of structure, relative to the conceptual resources of the theories, languages employed in their description. In Zermelo-Ferenkel set theory, what is said about domain of individuals. Perhaps rather than providing us with an insight into the way in which these very ancient, yes, which certainly exercised great influence over human thought, and which certainly exercised a very important heuristic function in guiding the way in which we form our conceptions, which we have formed our conceptions, the way in which we have accommodated conceptual language of description. So rather than view category theory, you have to have a paragraph in your footnotes about how initially alternative primitive conceptual basis view of category theory is providing a sort of primitive alternative conceptual basis, alternative primitive conceptual basis for organization of insights and organization of understanding the relationship between mathematical structures, one which, in the sense of allowing an increase in dimension by one, inverted commas, allowed us to deal with variation in structure. This is Lorvier's contention. And especially variation in structure, to evolve a theory of variation of structure, not in terms of domain of variation and succession of fixed structures, one for each point, as it were, in the domain of variation. One which, from the point of view of the of a nonsense theoretical view of the foundations of mathematics, one from the point of view of conviction expressed by Putnam, that mathematics is in some sense concerned with the study of abstract possible structures, allow the expression of certain convictions concerning what kinds of structure might in principle be considered as candidates for abstract possible structures, vis-a-vis the ways in which our very general conceptions of the world and ontological hypotheses, very general principles of coherence of the ontology, see Hooker, might be brought together. Having been brought together at the level of relations between very general conceptions, very general view concerning the kind of structures to be encountered in investigation of the world, relationships between these ways in which conceptions of them might be accommodated to one another, see Burr, which have been arrived at by qualitative and imaginative reflection at the level of consideration of conceptual structure independently and under the guidance of very general heuristic metaphysical principles, might then find expression
in enlarging mathematical formalism. See 1930 Dirac paper at this point about the way that the mathematical formalism of mathematics has evolved. This proved to be over hasty and over ambitious. And it turns out that it is rather perhaps in the employment of category theory as a tool in the organization of mathematical insights. Organization in our view of the relations between mathematical structures, not from the point of view of trying to bring those into conformity with the kinds of polarities, kind of organization, view of relationships between primitive conceptual bases for the organization of mathematical knowledge, of the kind which we might view as significant from the point of view of concept, very the way in which we characterize very broad general conceptions, competing very broad general conceptions from the point of view of alternative bases, views of the primitive the principle of coherence of our ontology, but rather in systematization of insights, the Castong way on the role of heuristics, as it were, in crystallizing heuristics. Insights, allowing them to be crystallized, the role of adjointness, and thus the organization of our mathematical knowledge at a higher level of abstraction, see Castong way for this, allows, as it were, the development of a mathematical viewpoint on the mathematical structures involved in the formalisms, which are related quite independently of and without any direct employment of heuristic insight derived from that sort of very broad, that sort of reflection on very broad general conceptions of kinds of natural order discussed by Boehm. What you were going to say when you started this tape was that as regards competition with atomism,
we should certainly not lightly cast aside regard as debarred from consideration analysis of the role of these alternative, very broad general conceptions of conceptualizations of reality. Because, quoting Hagedorn, it would be idle to deny that of the identity of structures as some in some way bound up with involving a relationship to the whole natural order, as in some way involving a nisus to the whole. The idea of Leibniz's monads, for instance, the idea of the natural that we may encounter at the most fundamental level, in penetrating the most fundamental level of description, at the most fundamental level of description, this conception. The conception we discussed, sketched at the beginning of atomism founders, and an account of the kinds of structures it will encounter involves
reference to the way in which the identity of it involves recognition in some way of the identity of the units involved as being in some way tied up with the whole in some mysterious way, nisus to the whole, that this is an idea, a pervasive thesis, recurrent throughout the history of metaphysical speculation, has exercised a very important heuristic role in the program of a number of scientists, and that we should not lightly cast it aside, we should not lightly ignore it just because it is recalcitrant to formalization in terms of referential semantics, which we currently employ. Referential semantics, moreover, founded on first order theories, very general questions about the way in which the evolution of our mathematical formalism determines our conception of the way that properties can go together. And this is in turn related to very fundamental metaphysical questions which we could ask about our mathematical conceptions, relationship between our mathematical conceptions, mathematical devices, and our conceptualization of physical reality, the various levels of abstraction at which our conceptualization of physical reality and heuristic view of mathematics, the relationship between mathematical structures might be connected, themselves involve, themselves touch on non-set theoretical views of foundations of mathematics, which must touch on and describe whether these have any coherence at all. But at the same, and touch on nonlinear sheaf theory and various important questions about nonlinear and linear, and so on, that you will discuss here. But by the same token, the very antiquity and pervasiveness of theses of this kind should not, and the heuristic role that they have influenced should not debar us from ruling them as out as wholly misleading if we are finally convinced that there is no way in principle that they can be made intelligible, that what there is of cognitive value in heuristic value in guiding speculations which can in principle prove fruitful to science, let alone direct influence on the construction of scientific theories themselves, but direct ways of influencing the construction of scientific theories. If we're convinced that what there is of cognitive significance can be expressed, can already be expressed in terms of adapted and extended kind of referential semantics, that and in such a way that it is no longer significant to talk of a particular metaphysical conception, one particular metaphysical conception which we've attempted to characterize in the sense of when we're talking about atomism as against another related metaphysical conceptions as in any sense vindicated by the employment of one mathematical formalism as against another, metaphysical conceptions as implicated in the employment of mathematical formalisms or in the perspectives for their development, the view that they are just associated associated with Hakka, amongst others. Berm is a source of a great deal. It's very misleading. At the same time, it's quite easy to understand why. So pervasive and so tempting to somebody with a scientific, systematic turn of mind who agrees with Einstein in demanding of physical theories to know what there is in the world. I shall show, I hope, how it is misleading.
At the same time, we should not regard ourselves as debarred from passing verdict on these, in some sense, metaphysical speculations, and assessing their heuristic fruitfulness. If we have come to the conclusion that is no, that in some sense the employment of this task in semantics indicates an atomistic conception of reality, the precise significance I wish to attach to that become much clearer later on. We examine the kind of difficulties for referential semantics that are raised by certain views of the nature of the difficulties, ways in which our view of attempted resolution of the difficulties arising from the attempt to apply systematizations in terms of the universes and models of some scientific theory related to our intuitive and general heuristic connections between conceptions of the ways that variables can arrange over domains, in some sense, in the natural world. How our solution to this problem might be influenced by non-atomistic conceptions. See all about algebra and analysis in Quine, and discuss the significance of this in philosophy of mathematics and your difficulties, how your speculations went astray.
In some sense, as of indicating atomism, though in another, as perhaps showing the superiority ways of formulating the difficulties, the conceptual difficulties, certain difficulties dissolved. Being driven at here will, I hope, become clearer as in the sequel.
The 40th anniversary of one of the more controversial forms of treatment used by psychiatrists.
Science Now.
Electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT.
15th February, 1978.
In a patient under anaesthetic, by means of an electric current passed through electrodes placed on the side of the head. Many doctors believe in ECT's efficacy, saying that it helps lift depression and can even alleviate symptoms of intractable conditions like schizophrenia. Others disagree, though. They argue that there's little evidence that ECT is anything more than an elaborate placebo. It doesn't actually do anything to the mechanisms of the brain. It simply encourages the patient or victim to think that it's helping him. In fact, there's the story of the ECT machine that was used for some months on patients before someone came along and discovered that the machine wasn't even working properly. Further proof, it's reckoned, of the placebo theory. And some doctors even argue that ECT is decidedly harmful. But whatever the pros and cons of ECT, it's still used in psychiatry, even though nobody's quite sure how it works. One recent suggestion is that ECT's action is something like that of the powerful psychotropic drugs that work directly on the brain, altering moods and feelings and also behavior. Many of these drugs affect the production in the brain of natural substances called monoamines, especially serotonin, dopamine, and noradrenaline, which get released round the brain's nerve endings at times of increased activity or excitement. One group of drugs in particular, the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, actually stops the amines being broken down. And because they're successful in treating depression, it's logical to assume that amine production and release cause high or low moods. Now, drug treatments for psychiatric conditions like depression are often used in conjunction with ECT. So there's a case, it would seem, for trying to find out whether the two forms of treatment complement each other, and if so, how. That was the objective of Professor David Graham Smith at the Medical Research Council's Clinical Pharmacology Unit in Oxford. His subjects, though, aren't humans, but rats, though the processes involved in the rat brain's amine secretion are, he contends, very similar. Here he is to take up the story.
We wanted to see whether, in fact, electroconvulsive shock given to rats in approximately the same sort of way that it's given to human beings, whether, in fact, electroconvulsive shocks changed the way that animals would respond to manipulation of their brain monoamines.
And you carried out experiments to that end?
Yes, indeed. There had been some previous work on this, which actually had not, I think, really come to very much. We started off by giving our animals an anaesthetic in the same way as we give human beings anaesthetic who are undergoing this sort of treatment, and then administering a shock through the head, which caused a convulsion. And we gave one shot to start with and looked at our animals 24 hours later when they'd come round, and they seemed quite normal. And then we studied the effect of increasing serotonin and dopamine function in the rat's brain. And 24 hours after one shock, the rats are absolutely normal, and they react absolutely normally in no particular difference to controlled animals at all. And we were then rather disappointed. But it occurred to us, of course, that in fact this isn't the way that electroconvulsive therapy is given to human beings. Normally it's given, say, twice or three times a week for 2 or 3 weeks, depending upon the patient's response. In other words, a repeated convulsive shock is given. And so we carried out experiments as closely as possible then, tailored to the human situation, and we found that, in fact, depends a little bit how you do it, but after 3 or 4 or 5 repeated shocks, the animals show a very greatly increased behavioral response to increasing serotonin and dopamine function in their brain. It's very clear, and during the work we attempted to dissect out at what point electroconvulsive shocks were having this effect, and as far as we've gone at the moment, it seems as if repeated electroconvulsive shock actually changes the way that the brain responds to either a serotonin or a dopamine or probably a noradrenaline challenge. Now, in regard to noradrenaline, I have to say that that work has been done in Sweden by a good friend of ours named Kjell Mudig, and he has been studying the noradrenaline aspect of things, whereas we have stuck so far mainly to the serotonin and the dopamine aspect.
Can you enlarge a little bit on that, about the way it changes the response?
Yes. At the moment, we don't know precisely the mechanism of this, but it seems as if the signal that, say, comes out of a serotonin or dopamine nerve ending after electroconvulsive shock, in a sense, is amplified more by the neuron that comes after. In other words, the signal that is propagated seems to be greater. The nerves seem to be more sensitive to serotonin and dopamine. And to some extent, this fits very vaguely what we think happens with tricyclic antidepressant drugs and monoamine oxidase inhibitors in the treatment of depression. There, you are increasing the function either by stopping the metabolism or stopping the inactivation of the monoamines. With electroconvulsive shock, what you are doing is you are increasing the intrinsic activity of the monoamines. It's another way of doing the same sort of thing. This makes us feel that probably it has got some relevance to the way that electroconvulsive therapy works in depression in human beings.
You seem, if I may say so, very confident of the applicability of your animal studies here to the human situation.
Well, I don't want to be too confident because it's a big gap between rat and man, but the findings we have do fit the general so-called monoamine hypothesis of depressive illness.
I mean, one controversial aspect, I suppose, of ECT has been that it has, as you said, appeared to work in some cases, but people don't know why. And do you think that really you're just, as it were, giving us the biological basis for why it works, and thereby perhaps scotching a lot of these controversies?
One can't tell how people will react, because it depends what irons are in the fire. But on the other hand, I would think, and I think most people are fairly rational, if they know that there is a rational basis for some kind of treatment, it reassures people that one isn't being absolutely ridiculous in applying the treatment. It's sometimes very difficult to convince people that an empirical treatment does actually work, even though you don't know how it works. If in fact you can put some evidence before people, A, that it does work, and then B, that it works because of this particular mode of action, then I think they are more reassured, or at least they ought to be.
Professor David Graham-Smith and the puzzlingly subtle biochemistry of the brain. Of course, there are some very real problems in studying the living human brain encased in its thick bony box. But a lot of valuable work on psychiatric illness does take place on donated dead brains, which, if suitably preserved, can last for years before they give way to deterioration. That makes the recent discussions at the Medical Research Council about how to enlarge its brain bank of particular interest to those engaged in the baffling business of understanding the mechanisms of mental illness. It's a baffling but not necessarily impossible task, though. Already, brains from the bodies of donors have been of direct use in devising treatments for conditions like Parkinson's disease, or in giving further insights into the biochemistry underlying senile dementia and schizophrenia. It's schizophrenia in particular that interests psychiatrist Tim Crow of the Clinical Research Centre in Harrow, and he told me how the brain bank went into business.
A number of MRC centres have joined together in organising a brain bank. Cambridge is one, ourselves at Norfolk Park is another, and we are gradually encouraging the supply of brains to be fed in, and we're standardising the procedures for dissecting these brains, and to a certain extent the procedures for estimating various chemicals in the brain. And this is gradually building up a bank of expertise and information which I think will prove increasingly more useful with the passage of time.
From the point of view of your own research, which aspects in particular excite you about the possibility of having more brains at your disposal?
We're interested in schizophrenia, and we're particularly interested in the chemical dopamine in schizophrenia. The reason for this is that a lot of research on schizophrenia has suggested that dopaminergic mechanisms are important. In particular, there's a lot of evidence that blockade of dopamine is the mechanism by which the various drugs we have for treating schizophrenia may work. It seems as though all these drugs are effective blockers of dopamine. And obviously one might wonder whether there is something wrong with the normal dopaminergic mechanisms in patients with schizophrenia. We looked at this in our brain samples. We found there was no evidence really of an increased turnover of dopamine, which is what I think a lot of workers had suspected there might be. and that ruled out one possibility. Then we went on, however, to look not at the dopamine neuron, that is the nerve cell that contains dopamine, but at the nerve cell which it acts on, the dopamine receptor, as it's called. We did find that there were differences between the brains from patients with schizophrenia and our control brains. In schizophrenia, we found evidence of increased sensitivity of the receptors, of the dopamine receptor. And it could be that this is something to do with the basic disease process. What we're particularly concerned with now is whether it could possibly just be a secondary consequence of drug administration. It's possible that receptors may become supersensitive with the sort of drugs that are used in schizophrenia, and this is something we're really concentrating on at the moment.
Presumably, you've constantly got the problem with brains that come into your hands for research purposes of them having been treated for possibly long periods in psychiatric hospitals by various drug therapies.
This is a very important issue. Drugs may confuse a lot of the findings on post-mortem brains, and I think this is widely recognized by workers in the field now. And what we are particularly interested in is obtaining brains from patients who may not have been treated for long periods with neuroleptic drugs, that is, with the antipsychotic drugs used in schizophrenia. If we can find such cases, then we're exceptionally interested in those.
But these would be people with the condition?
Absolutely. The other possibility, of course, is that we might be able to separate out this question of the influence of drugs by looking at patients who did not have the disease, but yet were treated with the same sort of drugs. And there are a number of such patients who do receive this type of drug, for example, for prolonged vomiting, and we're trying to obtain that sort of brain as well.
In countries like Britain, an awful lot of psychotropic drugs are used. Is it possible to find brains that haven't been oversensitized in this way?
Well, it's certainly true that most long-stay psychiatric patients are treated with drugs. I think possibly they are over-treated in Britain in some instances. But there are a number of patients who don't receive such medication. Often it doesn't seem to be effective, and often the side effects outweigh the benefits. And where there are such cases, we are particularly interested in them, of course.
But even at the level of the GP, psychotropic drugs are frequently prescribed. Would you need to go outside the industrialised countries where lots of tranquilizers and so on are used to find brains?
This is certainly worth considering, and recently we have made some contact with the World Health Organization, who have some information on possible sources of brains from countries where psychotropic drugs are not quite so widely used as they are here.
What sort of brains do you get hold of? Are you mostly looking at brains of people who've had some kind of mental disorder or not?
Well, of course, all the time we have to match the condition we're interested in with control brains, that is, brains of patients who don't suffer from neurological or psychiatric disease, to show that any abnormality we may find is related to that particular disease, and not, for example, a post-mortem change in the brains. So we're collecting really normal brains and brains of patients with disease.
Now, to get brains for your research, presumably they need to be donated.
Yes, of course. Patients before their death or their relatives have to have agreed to a post-mortem being carried out and to the brain being taken, parts of the brain being used for research.
But unless they are donated, your hands are effectively tied to those that come your way.
That's right, yes, which may be at the moment fairly limited, but I think the idea is getting around that this is an important area of research which ought to be encouraged, and we're most anxious to encourage people to collaborate with this sort of project wherever they have an opportunity.
Dr. Tim Crowe with a plea for more brain donors. Perhaps we really ought to have brain donor cards in our pockets as we do for other organs urgently needed to save or prolong lives. Now a piece of geological speculation that must deserve some credit if only for the ingenious simplicity of its research method. It's the finding made by John Saul and reported in the journal Nature. He contends that the surface of the Earth shows large, faint circular patterns that have never been seen before. The circles are remarkable in that they appear to be near perfect in outline, and their size, up to 700 kilometres across, suggests some pretty violent geological events. What I find equally remarkable, though, is the way the rings were found, by taking ordinary commercial relief maps of various parts of America and shining a light across them at a low angle. The shadows were then photographed, and lo and behold, the circles appeared. It's certainly a new kind of topography, though more likely to be done using satellite pictures of the Earth's surface. And it's led Saul to another interesting discovery, namely that the regular circular structures conform very closely to mineral deposits, particularly valuable substances like lead, copper, and gold. So, speculative or not, his paper could be of some commercial importance. Professor John Sutton of Imperial College talked to me about Saul's work and began by speculating on what could have caused the rings.
They might be connected with an event which is really one of the geological mysteries at the present time. We know from what we know about the Moon and Mercury that early in the history of the solar system, about 4,000 million years ago, there was much more debris in the solar system than at the present time, and there were many collisions between...
These are notes hastily compiled on the afternoon of the 16th of February 1978. With respect to questions about intertheoretic explanation, the contrast which we want to touch on here, we're concerned whether a logical reconstruction of inter-theory relations of the kind criticised by those who favour the genetic and historical approach. See all of Graves' remarks about models and explanation, the roles of models as ontological hypotheses in explanations. The great objection to an attempt to base an account of inter-theoretic explanation, which clarifies the nature of the distinction between the kind of inter-theoretic explanation which can be regarded as properly truth-functional, which is in fact to be viewed as a reduction, in the sense discussed in Castonguay's remarks at the beginning of his chapter on inter-theoretic explanation in mathematics and science, the kind which actually affects a reduction. That is to say that with respect to the resources of some background theory, we can speak without residue, we can talk, we can characterise all the properties of, we can characterise those entities completely in terms of the relations and structures we can define on the domain of our background theory. In the case of theories in science, for instance, we can characterize all the properties of the real numbers in terms of sets. C. Scott, his remarks about sets and real numbers. Of course, the heuristic component of our theory of the real numbers, the kinds of theorems that we are liable to want to prove about the real numbers, the kinds of properties of the real numbers, kind of properties of one mathematical structure which suggest that it may possess other interesting properties, the kinds of properties our existing grasp on the properties of one mathematical structure, allowing ourselves to talk in the informally Platonistic way of speaking, which is so convenient and universally tempting in mathematics. See remarks about this in Platinum and Castonguay also. The properties which we regard, which we already regard our structures having, ways in which perhaps the properties of other structures of interest to us from the point of view of problematic of our theory, talking now purely in terms of mathematical theories, are in their turn to be represented in terms of this structure in terms of the perhaps by representing operations on quantities of some formalism in terms of some other mathematical structure, in terms of expressing them in terms of some other mathematical structure, such that some broader set of operations with respect to which they're invariant, or some which we're talking now purely in terms of mathematical viewpoint of operations on quantities, not any assigning the Bohm's error, which we're going to come to discuss when you discuss his metaphysics, develop a critique of his metaphysics, compare Sachs and Bohm and others. Not a question of assigning any sort of extra mathematical significance, any significance at all, other than in terms of the structural relations, relationships between structures which we are investigating in terms of mathematics, and in which relations we can in turn map into some further background theory. There's one, until we reach the one background theory in terms of which we can develop the properties, recover the properties of all the higher order relations between these structures that we've studied from the point of view of the interests that concern us in our specific inter-mathematical theoretical problematic, as it were, at a lesser level of generality, and from the level of on which we are attempting to develop a point of on which we expect to find interesting conformities, interesting uniformities, relationships between these structures, such as will allow their representation. Now talking in terms of ITRs of maths theories, not at the level of the fundamental theory of foundations theory, but in terms of the heuristic interplay of heuristic considerations operating within mathematics itself. We're concerned to find a way of describing the way in which that interplay of heuristic considerations within mathematical theories is operative in establishing perspective which is of significance. Establishing perspective on the unification of structures which connects with conceptual problems, deep conceptual problems in the highly abstract or highly mathematized physical theories, in physical mathematics. The way in which we do this is likely to be historic, but of course the argument for this is only an historical argument, and as it were an heuristic argument, is to be by developing, see the 1930 Dirac paper, for instance an account of the relationship between the structures in the mathematical formalisms of our existing theories from the point of view of the kind of hints at unification, hints of level of relationships, ITRs, between mathematical theories from the strictly mathematical viewpoint, which suggests ways in which for instance, operations on the quantities, the mathematical formalism in one mathematical theory, which are, for instance, which allow, don't, from the point of view of, this is where we're discussing the relationship between syntax and semantics of a scientific theory, the conceptual structure employed in the formulation of descriptive schemes and the mathematical formalism don't allow, don't provide Any clue as to why, for instance, parameters which occur in the formalism, which are now being viewed as physically significant parameters, not as pure mathematical quantities on which the operations and quantities, the operations on which we perform, have a purely mathematical significance, which in its turn is to be studied from the point of view of relevant mathematical disciplines, tend to cut the berm position, of course, tends to cut right across this and see the connection between global and local structure as discussed in Penrose, mentioning Penrose and discussed in MTW73. Rather, the values of the parameters and the formalism, which assume a definite physical significance, is arbitrary in some sense. We have a perspective discussed in the use Penrose makes of SL2C in deriving the dimensionality, actual values of the dimensions, in description of space-time structure. That's one viewpoint, but there's a slightly ad hoc way, mentioned in the article in Mera, article on space-time structure, which made the remark about the non-constructive nature of Eller's article. I think it was the remark about the non-constructive nature of the reals, and remark about the SL2C, the way that Penrose uses the SL2C. Structure to get at the spine of formalism for a description of the properties of space-time from the point of view of the certain features of the conceptual structure of general relativity, actually from this case from the point of view of the description of a viewpoint on the structures of general relativity, rising the mathematical formalism of general relativity, which regards the clue to their significance as lying in the ease with which mathematical formalism, mathematical viewpoint on the mathematical formalism, allows us to re-express operations on them, re-express the structure, the mathematical rising of the mathematical formalism of general relativity in some of its early formulations in terms which allow us to see clearly the conceptual significance of certain quantities. Conceptual significance of certain quantities from the point of view of a further background perspective, heuristic perspective on the way in which the unification of those the structures the mathematical formalism which those quantities are with respect to which those quantities are defined, which has perhaps much in common from the SL2C viewpoint with the sort of locally based. It's already filtered through and affected by the conceptual structure, view of the conceptual, the fundamental concepts involved, the way in which we're likely to be able to give an account of one set of fundamental concepts, reputatively fundamental concepts, of one discipline in terms of those of another, trying to find some sort of unification. But there's a certain level of sophistication which is at the same time also, this is most important what you're going to say now, the level of sophistication, that is to say the level of which we've taken into account the conceptualization and the putative conceptual significance of the representation of quantities in mathematical formalism in terms of the structure of the mathematical formalism previous formulations of mathematical formalism reformulated in a mathematically equivalent from a mathematically equivalent way, which brings out the importance of a particular quantity in the formalism, with respect to which the original earlier formulation of the formalism was, has been re-expressed, is S, for instance, spinors, as against tensors, which already incorporates a way of conceptualizing the matter of this particular theory. I'm not expressing this very well, but what I want to get at is a way of characterizing the distinction between the extremely general and inevitably very vague and intuitive attempt to get at the significance of informal conceptual structure for our understanding of the ways in which we might, and the level at which we might unify the mathematical formalisms, which, as it were, starts from the conceptual structure. As is discussed in Hooker's remarks about the role of informal conceptual structure, and Bohm, which we make sense in terms of the mathematical formal, metaphysical significance of particular kinds of order, and actually read back the significance of those kinds of orders go back from our metaphysical conviction as to the significance of those particular conceptions of all kinds of order and principles of coherence of ontology, and terms in which, without considering whether such a level of metaphysical speculation can ever constitute a viable basis for explanation, level of explanation, what in fact has to. Hence the importance of what you were saying earlier on about the importance of the theory of truth, of the truth under an interpretation, in the sense of formal semantics, and the theory of models, of first order and higher order logics, for our treatment of inter-theory relations. Compare this with this, which seems to be the most extreme form of the approach which treats the conceptual aspect of the relationship between the putative levels of description, the conceptual structure, and the ontology. The putative principle of coherence of the ontology as primary, the role of informal conceptual structure as primary, and then attempts to actually formulate directly a kind of mathematization of the conception arrived at by means of this speculation, and to identify the significance of the structures, the mathematical formalism, in this case actually the very notion of identity itself, in regard to Bohm's discussion of explicate order and the importance and the significance he attaches to Cartesian coordinate systems, in terms of that, which seems to me to be completely mistaken, but I want to be in a position to discuss the way that qualitative geometrical, for instance, approaches to mathematical structures in, for instance, the theory of ordinary differential equations, which played down the importance of the coordinate-based approach, might be developed to the point where we can actually attach some real sense to the question, which apparently from the point of view of attitude to foundations, talking about foundations of mathematical knowledge, set theoretical and any mature non-set theoretical sense of category theory, see Scott's quite correct remarks about the notion of functional correspondence and being such a fundamental in a way which does not allow us to take view of category as space of allowed functions as allowing us to get at a way of formulating the opposition between our the principles of coherence of ontology, which is supposedly implicated in the debate between Boehm and to which Hooker certainly seems tempted to subscribe in some of his passages, and a logical reconstruction, also a point of view which has no time for so-called quantum logics.